Hello, and welcome back to another edition of YCT Matters. This is Carol Platt-Liebau, president of Yankee Institute, and today we have a truly special treat for you. With us is one of the great stars of the pro-freedom legal movement. His name is Bill Messenger, and he is vice president and legal director of National Right to Work. And his significance in the legal firmament is especially tagged to an event we have all been marking recently, which is the anniversary of the Janus decision. And I'll let Bill explain more, but he holds an even higher place in the Yankee firmament because he has the honor and the distinction of being married to Yankee's former executive VP, Elizabeth Kynes Messenger. So, Bill, welcome, and thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you, and thank you for having me on. And as you probably know, the two are actually linked, and we can maybe discuss that later between Janus and Elizabeth being my wife. So
Exactly.
Two very good things.
Two wonderful things. And so let's talk a little bit before we get to the Janus decision itself, where you were the person who made the oral arguments that we think ultimately persuaded the justices to rule in Mark Janus's favor. Let's talk a little bit about the legal landscape before the Janus case ultimately came to the Supreme Court. Could you fill us in about what the legal landscape looked like and where things were when Mark Janus's case was accepted for cert by the Supreme Court?
Sure. And really, it stretches back actually to the 1970s. The National Right to Work Foundation has been challenging the constitutionality of forced fees, since the 1970s, actually our founding in 1968. And the issue with compulsory unionism in the government sector is you have the government forcing public servants to pay money to a union to keep their jobs. As public school teachers, as state employees, you have it. And so that raises serious First Amendment issues, because now you have the government forcing individuals to support these politicized special interest groups and their messages as a condition of keeping their jobs. And so the first case to reach the Supreme Court is a foundation case in the 1970s. It was called Abood versus Detroit Board of Education. And in that case, the court held, well, it's permissible to force employees to pay for the union's cost of bargaining with the government and things related to that, but it's unconstitutional to force employees to pay for the union's political expenses and things unrelated to bargaining with the government. So Abood sort of created that dichotomy between what's called a chargeable expense and non-chargeable. Now, at the time, some of the justices, Justice Powell, said that distinction doesn't make any sense because bargaining with the government is political. It's basically lobbying, really, bargaining right with the government over its employment policies. But that was the division the court created in Abood. So going from 1977 in Abood until the early aughts or late aughts, there was a lot of litigation, most of which by the Right to Work Foundation, over how do you make Abood work? What's chargeable, what's non-chargeable, a whole ton of issues related to that. But then in 2012, the court signaled in a case called Knox that it wanted to reconsider Abood, that maybe Abood didn't make any sense, but based on its holding in terms of its workability and other issues. And so in Knox, which is a foundation case brought in 2012, the Supreme Court called Abood an anomaly in its First Amendment jurisprudence. And anomaly is a very strong word, in a Supreme Court decision.
Absolutely.
And also made clear that this kind of forced fees raises serious First Amendment issues and is subject to the highest levels of First Amendment scrutiny. Following Knox, another case came 2 years later called Harris versus Quinn, which I had the honor of arguing that case. And the issue in Harris was whether the government can force people who are not government employees to pay dues to the union. These are individuals, Pam Harris and others, that are home health care providers. In Pam's case, she was providing care to her disabled son in her own home and getting some Medicaid money for providing that care. Well, they decided to declare her a public employee solely for unionization purposes and started skimming about 2% of all of these Medicaid payments from paying for services to people with disabilities to the unions.
Remind us, on what basis were the unions trying to declare a woman who was providing care to her own son in her own home a public employee?
It was just completely artificial. Just they said solely for purposes of the state's labor laws, we're going to call you a public employee, but not for any other purpose, not for getting a pension, you know, anything else.
Because the reality, what did they hang that on? Because she was accepting Medicare?
Yes.
How ridiculous!
Just because, basically, you know, as a reality, she's a Medicaid provider, no different than any other Medicaid provider, like a doctor who accepts Medicaid payments for taking care, you know, of someone. That doesn't make the doctor a government employee.
Can you imagine the precedent that would have set? Because pretty soon then they could have declared every doctor who treats clients on Medicaid to be government workers and unionize them next.
Don't give them any ideas.
Right.
But these home health care providers, you know, that's one of the biggest growing fields in the country. And a lot of are paid directly by the government. And over 500,000 people were affected by this because the Californias of the world, Washington, Oregon, Illinois, started doing this. And it was a huge cash cow for the unions because literally they're just taking 2% out of these very large government programs for basically doing very little to nothing, really just lobbying the government over their Medicaid payments, rates made to these providers because they didn't really employ them. So the amount of money that states were funneling to unions through this scheme was immense and really reprehensible if you think about it. And these are programs that are supposed to benefit people with disabilities. Instead, the money is being funneled over to a special interest group, you know, aligned with certain politicians.
Well, and I don't want to interrupt you, but, you know, and it seems to me that's one of the biggest problems, policy problems these days, is that the left has embedded all these funding sources within the government. And, you know, the question is, how can people who oppose their policy agenda really get in there and try and decouple this sort of incestuous relationship where they figure out ways to actually fund themselves through the tax dollars of people who don't agree with them. But you did it. So go ahead.
Well, striving in that direction. And we tried. And so we challenged the National Right to Work Foundation, challenged these compulsory unionism requirements as applied to these independent healthcare providers and childcare providers, which is another world, is violating the First Amendment. So the Supreme Court took the case, it was called Harris versus Quinn in 2014, and the court said two things. First, it basically said, we think Abood is wrongly decided and doesn't make sense, and gave six reasons why Abood doesn't really pass muster, that there is no difference between bargaining with the government and politics in the public sector, that Abood's dichotomy doesn't work as a practical matter, that it's in conflict with other decisions. However, the court then said, but in this case, we don't need to overrule Abood, because we could just say it doesn't apply to these independent home care providers. And that's what the court held. So Harris versus Quinn, you know, freed about 500,000, if not more, of these home health care providers from these compulsory union fee requirements. But Abood was still on the books. And so after Harris, there were many other decisions, you know, trying to overrule Abood to get to the court. And ultimately, the one the court took was Janus, coming out of the Seventh Circuit out of Illinois. And the court ultimately ruled in Janus that, yes, Abood doesn't make sense. The court overruled that precedent, which is a huge step. Just for your readers or listeners who may not be familiar, generally speaking, the court sticks to its prior decisions under a doctrine known as stare decisis. Because that's sort of, so the court doesn't decide every case just without consideration of what came before it. However, the court, if a really high threshold is passed, will overrule a prior decision. And that's what it said about Abood, that Abood was basically so bad, so badly reasoned and had such bad consequences that they couldn't stick with it. And in Janus, they overruled it and held it was unconstitutional under the First Amendment for the government to compel any individual to pay money to a union to keep their jobs with the government. And so that decision basically gave First Amendment freedoms to about 5 million public employees as a result of that.
And their reasoning, was it, Bill, am I correct in saying that that membership in a government union is, in a sense, inherently political?
Yes, that the unions, public sector unions' actions are really political, that basically it's a political interest group. Its function is to bargain or lobby the government over its policies, and that's a political function. And so being forced to pay for that is no different than forcing a citizen to pay for any other special interest group. Because really, Abood and unions represented an exception to the normal rule. I mean, just as a general matter, no one thinks it would be constitutional for the government or, say, the state of Connecticut to force any person to support any special interest group. Connecticut can't declare that certain people have to support the Democratic Party or the Republican Party or any sort of other group, but there's always an exception for unions. And that never made sense because there's no reason unions are any different than any other special interest group. And that's sort of what the court recognized in Janus, that the same principle that applies to everybody also applies to unions, with one exception for lawyers, which is sort of funny. And state bars, that issue is still out there. But Janus sort of applied the general principle that under the First Amendment, everyone has the freedom to choose what organizations, if any, they want to support, what speech they want to support financially. And the court said that applies to unions and the government can't compel its employees to pay union dues or fees to keep their jobs.
So tell us a little bit about the day itself, because there was an enormous amount of press. And Mark Janus, I'm sure, who was the named plaintiff in the case, was the object of a great deal of publicity. And so, you know, for our listeners who have never been to a Supreme Court argument and have never really, you know, experienced the sort of the white hot light, what is that like for you as a litigator? And what was it like for Mark as the named plaintiff?
So for me as a litigator, it's just an incredible honor, you know, to be there and to be able to argue before the Supreme Court on behalf of Mark Janus and, you know, all the really effectively the millions of other employees whose interests may be impacted by it. You know, as you know, the Supreme Court's courtroom looks like it's right out of Central Casting. If you ask someone in LA.
In fact, that's probably where Central Casting got it.
Yeah, probably. And so it can be a bit of an intimidating forum. And, you know, for a litigator, one interesting sort of tidbit is that the podium is very close to the justices. There's not a lot of distance. And so it is a very personal thing, but obviously a great honor to be able to do it. And so that was for me as a litigator. For Mark Janus as an individual, as you said, very courageous and being able to stand under that white hot light of all that media attention, not only just to take the attention, but also to spread the message, you know, of worker freedom, the worker should have the freedom to choose, that this is wrong for the government to force him and his co-workers to pay money to a union to keep their jobs. And Mark did an incredible job of spreading that message, you know, because he was a public servant before all this. It wasn't like, you know, he's a professional, you know, plaintiff in his right. life. He was
just a regular person. Yeah.
He stepped forward. And I think that's just make a point on that. It's because of people like Mark that allow myself and others, the Right to Work Foundation, other organizations do our work. If an individual plaintiff doesn't step up, who's willing to step up and put themselves out there and allow us to represent them in a lawsuit challenging compulsory unionism and other things, the cases never happen. You know, without Mark Janus, that decision never happens, even if there's a ton of lawyers who would be more than happy to do it. And so it requires employees like Mark, like Pam Harris, like Knox, and like others before them. To step forward and bring these lawsuits, and that continues into the future.
Right, and for our people, the war is never over, or the battle. And you know, it's for our listeners who aren't lawyers. It's because there's something called standing, and you can have the greatest injustice in the world, but unless you have a courageous individual who has something that's called an injury in fact, where they can show that they, as a person, have been demonstrably harmed by what people like Bill will argue is a breach of the law, you can't bring a case. And that's probably a good thing. I mean, you know, you can't have these lawyers running all over, and I'm a lawyer, so, you know, I guess I'm one of them, running all over bringing lawsuits over things that have not been shown to harm a specific individual. But that means that you need people like Mark Janus who have the courage to stand up. And, you know, government unions don't generally appreciate people like Mark Janus. And so you are going to come in for a lot of scrutiny and a fair amount of criticism. But, you know, there are ways to handle it. And experts like Bill and people at National Right to Work are right by your side. And it's something that can be done and you know, is done. And so it's worth it when you find you've been wronged. So You know, one of the things that I think people find so interesting, Bill, about actually being a litigator in a court is the fact that, you know, people think that it's sort of these long orations like you see in movies like To Kill a Mockingbird, where, you know, lawyers get up and deliver lengthy monologues. But it's not really like that, is it?
No, and especially when I did the Janus argument, it was basically a free-for-all at the court. So you just say a few words and then the justices are asking questions. And obviously you stop talking and listen, you know, when a justice asks you a question and answer it, and there's nine of them. And so it's a lot of questions very quickly. It's changed a little bit since then. They changed some of the protocols during COVID. So now they tend to give a litigator a little bit of time to say their argument without interruption, and then generally take turns in asking questions. So it's not quite as much as the free-for-all, but very much it is a lot of questions, especially at the Supreme Court level and appellate level. And so it keeps you on your toes.
Yeah, I bet it does. Yeah, you did this in 2018. So this was pre-COVID. And so, you know, whom do you think was your most avid questioner? I mean, it's not a good thing or a bad thing. It's just a thing. And so it's, you know, was there anyone who was particularly active in leading the questioning, or was everybody kind of in on it?
To a large degree, it felt like everyone was in on it. It's odd. It feels like a blur.
I bet it does.
30 minutes. But 30 minutes feels like it's 10 seconds. Unless, of course, you don't know an answer, then it feels like an eternity.
Right.
Generally speaking, it feels, you know.
Knowing an answer was not a problem you were afflicted with. So I bet it felt like 10 seconds.
It went very quickly. I remember Justice Sotomayor and Justice Kagan asking a lot of questions is the first that come to mind. But there were definitely, you know, some very active questioners that day.
And it's interesting. I've heard about there being, as George W. Bush would have put it, some strategery even about justices sometimes who are even in favor of a case asking a question that will bring out a point they want their colleagues to hear, not necessarily in this case, but just in general. And it's just interesting to hear about how the different justices go about it. And some, like Justice Thomas, I know, you know, aren't particularly active questioners, but they read the briefs carefully and produce incredible jurisprudence, like Justice Thomas, in my humble opinion.
Absolutely. And I think, as you said, a lot of the questions are not really questions they're looking for answers to. They're more talking to their colleague through the attorney. This is a problem in the hope that one of the their fellow justices or judges, you know, who they're hoping to persuade to go with that. So ultimately, at the end of the oral argument, you know, they come together and try to see, you know, how who believes what. And so there is some, you know, back and forth, I imagine. It's all behind closed doors, so I don't know. But obviously, you know, you have to get to five votes to get a, you know, decision. And so there is some back and forth of that. And so sometimes oral argument is more for one justice trying to persuade another as much as it is for really wanting an answer to a question.
Yeah. And so as we wind up, Bill, where do you see the next frontier being? You know, in the wake of Janus, do you see other cases coming to the fore, or is that something anyone can really have a bead on? Or, you know, where do you see the workers' rights, the government workers' rights going in the future?
Sure, I would say three. The most direct is in the wake of Janus, a number of states, including Connecticut, took measures to try to dilute its impact.
And yes, mainly, they have.
What the states have done is either try to make it easier for unions to get employees to sign cards saying they agree to government dues deductions, they agree to be union members, and also to make it very hard to get out of the union with window periods and things to that effect. In Connecticut, I believe it was S908 did that, gave unions access to employee information, access to state workplaces, required employees to go to union orientations as part of their onboarding process as a new employee.
And also, don't provide employers with the same rights to talk to their workers.
Yeah, and which is amazing. So Connecticut, in addition to doing that, also banned captive audience meetings by private sector employers.
Yes. So
Connecticut's all for mandatory meetings if it's with a union, but is against it if it's being done by a private employer.
That's what I mean. Thank you for clarifying for me.
And then also with the government dues deductions, Connecticut law now requires that a Connecticut public employer has to just blindly trust whatever the union tells them. about taking dues from an individual. So if a union says, take money from this person, we say they authorized it, the government employer just has to blindly do it without actually looking to see, did the employee truly do it? And also any request to cancellation have to go through the union. So basically making it easy for unions to bring people in and difficult for employees to get people out. And so there's a lot of litigation over these efforts by Connecticut and other states to try to impede employees' First Amendment rights under Janus. A second is challenging monopoly representation. You know, even after Janus, employees who are unionized, they can't be forced to pay money to a union, but they're still forced to accept union representation. And what that means is the union has the legal right both speak and contract for these individuals, even if they want nothing to do with the union. It's basically like a mandatory agent. And so there's cases that are challenging. This is a violation of freedom of association. Perhaps the lead case is in the Second Circuit, which also covers Connecticut. It's called Goldstein, which is a number of professors out of the City University of New York, represented by Right to Work Foundation attorneys in the Fairness Center, who I know you work with sometimes, challenging compulsionism there. And here, almost all the professors are Jewish professors, Zionists, who very much oppose the union that represents them because it pushes them very anti-Semitic positions, at least what they consider to be anti-Semitic.
Absolutely.
And so the question is, can these, you know, Zionist professors be forced to accept an exclusive representative that holds views that they consider antithetical, you know, to their core being and identity? So that's a case to watch. And then the final, just to move over to it, there's private sector workers. You know, right now, there's a number of right-to-work states. Private sector workers there can't be forced to pay union dues, but there's a number of non-right-to-work states, unfortunately, including Connecticut, where private sector workers can be forced to pay union dues to keep their jobs. And so the hope is to bring First Amendment and Janus protections to those First Amendment workers, because ultimately everyone, you know, private sector, public sector worker, you know, deserves the right to choose who they financially support and who they don't. Right now, Janus only really applies to government workers, but private sector workers should have that same freedom.
Absolutely. And as onerous as it is that that government workers are forced to be represented by a government union, whether or not they pay dues to that union, that is something that the unions often use to scare the workers into remaining. The idea that they would not be protected by the same protections that the other unionized workers have. And it's something that I wish our government workers understood better, because what too many don't understand is even if they do choose to leave the union and choose not to pay the union dues and be associated with the unions, they still remain protected by whatever agreement the union negotiates with state government.
That's right. It's unlawful for a union to discriminate against an employee for not being a member of the union, both as a matter of sort of state law and the duty of fair representation and as a First Amendment issue. We actually have a recent example from Connecticut. Joseph Mercer, who the foundation represented, yep, was a state trooper. And it's a complicated story, but the bottom line is he was denied a position in an emergency response team because he wasn't a union member, didn't support the union. They put him, didn't give him that position, put him into an administrative position, which had less opportunities for advancement. You know, we sued the state and the union, and ultimately there was a favorable settlement, you know, for Mr. Mercer because of that. And so I think Mr. Mercer's situation just illustrates that, you know, it's unlawful, you know, for a union to discriminate against an individual who they represent because of their non-member status. Because again, that individual is being forced to accept their representation. It's not as if they chose the union to represent them. They're being forced to accept the union's representation and contract, whether they like it or not. And so because of that, the individual can't be discriminated against under that contract.
Absolutely. Well, Bill Messenger, Vice President and Legal Director at National Right to Work Foundation, and most importantly, proud husband of former Yankee Institute EVP Elizabeth Kynes Messenger, We are so grateful to you for your path-breaking work, both in the Janus case and in other cases protecting government employees' constitutional rights. And, you know, like you, we believe that everyone who wants to be part of a union should be able to, but the people who don't should not be forced, compelled to belong to organizations they want to have no part of. And We're grateful for the wonderful work that National Right to Work Foundation does, that our friends at the Fairness Center do, and of course, AFFT, which Elizabeth leads, and Frank Ritchie, our labor fellow, of course, as you know, is busy training people as well here throughout the state how to negotiate more fairly and effectively for taxpayers. We want to encourage anyone in Connecticut who feels as though they have an issue, he or she has an issue, and thinks that they may have rights that are not being respected, to reach out to us, because we can help if help is needed. And Bill, we can't thank you enough for all that you're doing. Your star status is well deserved.
Well, thank you and the Yankee Institute for your great work and for having me on today. It's always a pleasure to talk to you and see you.
Well, thank you. It's our honor and our pleasure. We wish you all the best, and likewise to National Right to Work Foundation. Tell me the website where people who want to find out more about National Right to Work Foundation can be found.
Sure. It's nrtw.org. So nationalrighttowork.org.
Great. Thank you so much for being with us, and thanks for all your great work.
Thank you.
And thanks to all our listeners. This is Carol Platt-Liebau. We look forward to having you with us again on another edition of YCT Matters.
I'll show you around this place I call home.